This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Margaret Thatcher is proving to be as divisive in death as she was in life. Even as many around the world mourn her loss this week, others are celebrating. London police bracing for protests and possible violence at her funeral. And of course, privatization was a big part of her legacy. Under her watch, the UK saw the privatization of British Airways, British Petroleum, British Aerospace, Gas, British Steel, Rolls-Royce, and many other publicly owned resources. Sound familiar? Well, that may be because Governor McCrory is talking about privatizing Medicaid and the Commerce Department here in North Carolina. Welcome to this week's roundtable. Bob Korstad is here. He's a professor of public policy and history at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Carolyn Kruger is program director at Kids Voting Durham, and Loretta Beniti is senior political reporter at News 14 Carolina. Welcome to all of you. So nice to have you here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Loretta, let's talk about this news. Privatization, start with Medicaid. What's the story?
Well, Governor McCrory has been talking since he came into office that one of his top priorities is to fix Medicaid. It's broken. He needs to fix it. Every year, the state has a shortfall in Medicaid. We can't pay our bills for it. And he believes that the solution is let's put that burden onto private companies. He would like to start these managed care facilities across the state, three or four of them, where these private companies are going to bid in order to be the ones who provide the Medicaid services. The state will pay them on a per patient basis. And then all of the risk will be on these private companies. If they have cost overruns, they're the ones who are going to have to deal with the fact that the money isn't coming in that they need.
And he has some specific issues that he's looking at with regard to outcomes and costs. What are the particulars that he thinks sort of need to be fixed? What does he think the problem is?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems that we keep hearing, well, at least from Governor McCrory, is he feels as if the state is not treating patients as a whole and that therefore people are in this cycle where they just keep having to go back to the doctors or to the emergency room. And we're only looking at that one thing that's wrong with him right there. And he believes that if we create these managed care facilities where they have these health networks, therefore these patients are now suddenly going to have this network of doctors. And they're going to have to go to the doctor less because the doctors are going to be treating the entire patient instead of just the one ailment with the patient.
And these is essentially these companies would be getting their allotment of money. That's what they get. And they'll have to figure out how to not go over budget.
Well, and there lies the question. If they're going to try to figure out how to not go out over budget, these are for-profit companies. Therefore, are they going to cut down on services? Are they not going to offer as much to the patients? And that's the big question out there that a lot of the people in the medical field have is, okay, maybe this is a good idea that we're going to, you know, create these networks. But therefore, are the patients going to end up suffering in the long run?
Well, and by law, corporations are chartered to make their shareholder return the primary cause. They'll be sued if they don't. So if you didn't reduce service to get that shareholder return back, you'd be sued and lose your job as a CEO.
Well, exactly. So perhaps if things work the way that Governor McCrory says and the Secretary of DHHS says, when we start treating these patients as a whole, the costs will go down and therefore these companies will be able to make their profit. But that's probably going to be a hard sell for a lot of folks out there.
And the other issue that some opponents have raised is this question of transparency. If you're a part of the government, you owe us information and we have to see how you do business. If you are beholden to a board of directors, you have a different set of rules. We don't have to see how you do your business.
And certainly as a member of the media, we like as much of the transparency as possible. And these are already tough issues to have transparency on whenever you're dealing with medical issues and how medical issues are taken care of. So now if we move medical issues over to the private sector, it's going to be even harder to actually tell what's going on.
And it's not as though there's no management right now. There's something called Community Care of North Carolina that actually does some of this work now, right?
That's right. And they've been establishing this for quite some time. And I want to say it's some huge number, something like $1 billion that they've saved the state with this community
over
care.
Over 4 years, $1 billion.
$1 billion. Yeah. And you look at legislators who have helped in the formation of this and creating this. And these are Republican lawmakers who I'm not sure they're ready to throw this out, even though that the governor is looking at this privatization.
Saved $1 billion and this month won an award from a group called the Healthcare Leadership Council, which is made up of the chief executives of the nation's leading healthcare companies. They won an award for their informatics center that supplies care alerts, real-time patient data, and population management. They have, if you've been to their website, all kinds of quality improvement controls, auditing and reporting data, infinite number of reports on exactly what their outcomes are. And this is what we're trying to improve, I guess.
Right. I think that the argument for the governor and his administration is going to come back to the fact, but we still have cost overruns. They might be saving money, but we still have cost overruns.
So, Carolyn, let's talk a little bit about the organization you work with. You are the director of Kids Voting Durham, and maybe you should tell us a little bit about what you do.
So Kids Voting Durham is a nonpartisan effort. Part of the Durham County Cooperative Extension, and we try to help young people understand and believe in the power that they can have as active citizens and informed voters, to really look at issues, candidates, and ideas. And we do it in a little bit different way than our legislature does. Young people are much more tend towards non-divisive politics and try to look deliberatively at different issues. So looking at all different sides of the issue, who is this going to affect? Who is going to benefit from this? In one article that I read, there was a statement that the Medicaid deficit was taking money away from K-12 education. Well, how will they be held accountable for making sure that it goes to K-12 education if that happens? And those are the nitty-gritty questions that they sometimes feel that the adult media is not providing all the details to, and then it's very hard to find the details to, maybe not because media is not trying also, but because politicians are not being as transparent.
They're not as transparent, and they tend to frame the issues. So Loretta, you know, I mean, that we more or less have to follow along. And if they frame this in terms of public-private and somehow, define public as one thing and private as another, that's – we follow along. Do the students see it that way? Do they have an understanding of the difference between the way private companies work and the way the public sector works to provide service?
I think they have the ability to go out and learn about it. We really teach them to have conversations with people, to look at all sorts of different organizations and where they stand. So, yes, if that's an issue that they're looking at, they have. But they also see that it's not a matter of this or that, that we too often make two sides to an issue and we make it a debate. And that's not – they don't participate in democracy that way. They really believe that – to deliberate and to look at all sides of an issue rather than to stick to two sides and fight against each other. And I will tell you, one of the things that Kids Voting Durham encourages them to do is to come into every conversation and to come into contact with every piece of information thinking, everything I think about this could be wrong. This could change my mind. And that's not a sign of weakness of conviction. That's a sign that your convictions are really strong and really well held. And I believe they've articulated several times that they wish they saw more of that in our government instead of divisive politics.
Well, Bob Korstad, you're somebody who has studied history, particularly with regard to public policy. And we mentioned Margaret Thatcher, who, along with Ronald Reagan, I think were at the head of a sea change in global finance and in domestic economies. That's when the public sector and government really became dirty words. They were synonymous with that which cannot function. Tell us about a time before all that in the pre-Thatcher days when we thought that government was an agent of change and good.
Yeah, I mean, I think in North Carolina we have a long history of believing that the public sector and the public good is something that government ought to be involved with. I'll just say I think that North Carolina is actually has been a very divided and fairly deeply divided state for well over the past 100 years between what I'd characterize as a more conservative faction that favors limited government, low taxes, restrictive social spending, racial stratification in some cases, a tightly controlled electorate. And then on the other hand, a moderate, sometimes even progressive faction that's seen a larger role for government as a builder of infrastructure that's needed for state growth, as a guarantor of quality education for all children, and is a protector of every citizen's right to have a meaningful and productive life. And I think there have been some, you know, some wonderful examples of that, the Good Roads Program in terms of infrastructure, the support for higher education in the midst of the Great Depression, the Good Health Campaign after World War II that built the North Carolina Public Hospital and a lot of regional hospitals. Terry Sanford's efforts at education in the early 1960s and later his effort to address issues of poverty with the North Carolina Fund, Jim Hunt's Smart Start, and I think there are lots of other examples. And so I think what we're seeing here right now is this is a really kind of a battle that's been going on for a long time between what does the public mean, and what is the role of government? And I think we have people on very different sides of this. And we've had this argument in the United States and Great Britain too for a while.
We'll continue this discussion about the public and private sector as we take a look back at the news with Bob Korstad, professor of public policy and history at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. Carolyn Kruger is here. She's the program director at Kids Voting Durham. Loretta Beniti is the senior political reporter at News 14 Carolina. On the state of things, privatization in North Carolina, and the rest of the news just ahead. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Our news roundtable this week, Carolyn Kruger's here, program director at Kids Voting Durham. Loretta Beniti is senior political reporter at News 14 Carolina. Bob Korstad, a professor of public policy at Duke. Let's talk about this question of public versus private. There really is, I think, a widespread opinion abroad that the private sector, private business is more efficient and just generally does things better than government. Where did that idea come from, and how can it be substantiated?
Well, it's certainly rooted in American history, and from the 19th century, the development of industrialization. But I think there's always been a kind of a tension between particularly large corporations, this notion somehow that their power, their insight is the best generator of economic growth and economic development. But I think the economic historians and economists are pretty clear on the fact that at least since the Great Depression, that the public sector has actually played the larger role in economic development and growth in both in the United States and in large parts of the world. So this notion somehow that the small business or the private sector or the job creators is that's where a lot of people are going to work, but the kind of the larger macroeconomic policies and decisions that have to be made in order to create the environment for those jobs and for the prosperity of the country require large inputs from government and oversight from government on all kinds of different levels. So I think that a lot of this is about ideology and not about history.
Well, Loretta, that brings us, I think, to the Commerce Department, which the governor would also like to privatize. So first we need to know what it is the Commerce Department does and what it might mean to be in private hands.
Well, the big job of the Commerce Department is to bring businesses and grow businesses in North Carolina. And the governor is looking to create this so-called board of directors, this privatized board of directors. I believe the vice president for the Coca-Cola is going to be serving to begin this with that will put together their private resources to help bring companies to the state and help encourage companies to grow their companies within the state. Now, the governor will sit as the chairman of this board, so there will still be the government oversight. The Commerce Department will still oversee everything in the long run, and it will come back to the state. This is the public-private part, that it will come back to the state when they need incentives, when they need grants, that the state will then facilitate that in order to bring the companies here.
And what is it that the governor thinks is the problem with this all residing within the state government?
I think right now where he sees the problem is he feels like it's too fragmented, that we have the state trying to recruit companies here. We have different regions of the state trying to recruit companies. Then we have some nonprofits trying to recruit companies here. And people aren't necessarily working together. I think his thought is, okay, let's get everybody together under this board of directors, working as one team to try to do this and see if therefore we can recruit more people to the state. And it could cost less money because the state, therefore, you know, we give the state gives money towards some of these regional groups that are trying to recruit folks. His thought is maybe if we only have one group that's doing this, we won't have to spend quite so much money to bring them here.
Yeah, Bob?
Well, I think this is another another place where history is really important. I think in terms of industrial recruitment, we have to look at the history of, say, the tobacco industry and the textile industry in North Carolina. For years and years and years, they did everything they could to keep particularly high-wage and high-skilled companies from moving into North Carolina because they feared competition with the low-wage workers that they had. I mean, I think in Winston-Salem, Reynolds Tobacco Company put up a tremendous fight to keep breweries, Miller Brewery, and I know there's a whole history of other companies. So this idea that private business and the North Carolina's corporations are going to be the prime recruiters and the of new industry to compete with them is it seems absurd to me.
To help recruit our own competition,
right?
It is a little bit odd. The other question is if you make the free market argument, if this is something businesses really, really want and think is important, why don't businesses really, really just do it? Why do they need the government? After all, the government's the problem.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I mean, I can see the role that the financial industry has, banks, real estate companies. You know, they want new investors. They want new people who are going to open bank accounts. They want new people who are going to buy houses. I can see certain sectors of the economy and the business community who could play an important role in this. But somehow this idea that the private sector – you know, kind of undifferentiated should be the driver of this, I don't think is good public policy.
Carolyn, I want to ask you again this question about the distinction that young people might make between public and private. You know, there's an understanding also that there are certain goods the private sector just isn't going to give you. The private sector isn't going to give you clean air, right? They're going to try to make products at the lowest possible price, and you're going to have to police them to clean up their air because they don't – it's your air. It's social air. And it's a private manufacturing process. So when it goes out of my smokestack and goes across the public, somebody else has to be in charge of that, right? Somebody else has to be in charge of cleaning the public waterway because no particular company is going to take on the cost themselves and say, hey, they're not doing it downstream. Why should I? And something like a government has to both regulate that and in some cases provide the service of cleanup. Do young people sort of understand that distinction between what can and cannot be provided by the public, by the private industry?
I think they certainly deliberate it, and they know what they want out of their government. And when Kids Voting polls kids and asks them what are the most important issues to them, jobs and economic development are always at the top. They care less about the private and public than they do about how is my dad going to get a job? How am I going to get the job when I get out of school? Tell me how this works and tell me from these different perspectives like history and so that I can make up my mind about how I best support. And it frustrates them that not more adults pay attention to the local aspects of this, that in presidential years, 80% turnout, but most of us can't name our state legislators, you know, who represents us or pays attention to state politics or comes out to vote for it. Our last local election for city council, there was a 17% turnout. The one before that, it was a 9% turnout. Those people have as much to do with creating jobs and our economy as President Obama does. And they really wish adults understood that and modeled that for them better. And it was sort of shocking for me to hear from a journalist perspective that there are so few people in the press room covering this in North Carolina right now.
Yeah, Loretta, give us the news. Who's there?
Well, the press room used down at the legislative building, these are the folks that cover it day in, day out, used to be a full room. It's not anymore. There's a lot of empty desks. And the desks that are filled by very few publications. The News and Observer has multiple reporters down there. WRAL has multiple reporters down there. News 14 has multiple folks who cover this, along with the Associated Press. But then you see a bunch of empty desks there. with nobody covering this for other areas of the state. You pretty much noticed everybody I just said is located in the Raleigh region.
WUNC, we're there.
WUNC is there.
So, but that is it, and that's small. So two TV stations, WRA and News 14 Carolina, two news stations for the whole state are there. The newspaper, sure, the Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer owned by McClatchy, so essentially one company covering it for the press. And then this – so when it comes to accountability, which we were talking about with Medicaid, I guess the press is culpable there too. So how – tell us how they feel about the press. What's their sense, Carolyn?
Well, their sense is that in general there's not enough focus on local, which they really get affects their lives, and that there's not the hard-hitting questions that they would like. So there is a lot of high-level talk about private or public, but – really, again, their question is very concrete. How is this going to get my dad a job? How is this going to make it so I can get a job when I come out? And they want people talking in more concrete terms about that.
Well, I wonder how this debate has shifted. And, Bob, maybe you can give us a historical put it in context. Again, we go back to Maggie Thatcher and the Reagan administration when government became a dirty word. Right. Labor was shifted outside the frame of public power. Right. How did that happen? How was it possible that the de-democratization, right, that so much control went to boardrooms, so little to our legislatures? How did we let it happen?
Well, I think there was a frustration generally both in the United States and in Great Britain with the role of government, with the economic climate, economic prosperity in Britain, to be honest. I mean, some of the labor unions and particularly some of the strikes that happened were probably not politically very wise, and it created this atmosphere in which the conservatives could win control of the of the House of Parliament and bring in somebody like Maggie Thatcher. And you know, she came in with a very determined policy to really dismantle the public sector. She saw it as a kind of a bloated institution. She saw labor unions were too powerful. People partaking of the kind of generous social welfare programs that had been created in the wake of World War II, and she, you know, went about it in a very systematic way of breaking the power of unions and really breaking up these large government programs, public sector utilities and other things. What happened with all that, though, is the benefits didn't recur to the public. You know, in some ways like what happened in the Soviet Union. You know, you had all these big state institutions, and all of a sudden they get privatized, and you've got these trillionaires, or you know, and a lot of the same thing happened in England. I mean, the financial sector was the primary beneficiary of this whole change of the structure, and I think that the same thing is going to happen in North Carolina. And I think the intent, quite honestly, is there too. It's really hard to know what's behind all this. The public, after all, is us. It's the populace. It's not some other, and government is us. It's not some kind of marginalized or kind of alternative institution.
Right. It's not abstract at all. And those labor unions represented a majority of people who were so. I mean, that really is the question: where did the power go once the power went from those two powerful unions? Well, those are people. Where did it go? Who got it? And I guess you answered it, because what we noticed then beginning in 1980 is that what had been in lockstep, increases in productivity and increases in wages, were linked up until then. Right. Once we broke the unions, the productivity increased, corporate profits soared, and wages went flat.
Yeah. If you look at all the rewards of productivity increases in the last, I think it's since 1982, virtually all of it have gone to the top 1 or 2% of the population, which means that working class wages and standard of living has really been flat, and since the recent recession has really declined.
What do they think, Carolyn, you talked about the frustration that students feel. They see this as in a completely different framework than we discuss it and we in the media portray it. What would they like to see, and how do they see a way out of this? When they talk about solutions, how do they sound to you?
Well, I'll tell you the story that was one of my best kids voting moments. I was doing a program with a group of children from social services that were all unwed teens who had children. And we discussed the issues that were important to them, and crime was the biggest one. And so they came up with some solutions, because you can't go to your city council person and say, could you please solve crime for me? Mm-hmm. So there was two young ladies sitting next to each other. One of them had lost her brother in the last year to gang violence, and she wanted somebody who shot somebody to be put in jail for life, no matter how old they were, so that that wouldn't happen again. The young lady next to her had made some mistakes earlier in life, and she wanted there to be more leniency and more rehabilitation programs. She couldn't find a job to support her child. They had a very civil discussion about it, and in the end, they decided they couldn't agree with each other on that, but they could agree that creating more teen centers in Durham that were designed by teens and that teens wanted to go to and that were open later at night would help solve the problem of crime, and that's something they could work on together. And they see too little of that in our government at all levels, of people trying to find common ground as well as having these debates about different issues.
And that means bringing the people who are affected into the process.
Exactly.
Into the deliberative process.
Well, the ironic thing was that very day in the House, they were hearing testimony on lowering the age to try someone as an adult to 13. And it was very, very personally insulting. People were called soft on crime. Other people were called, you know, didn't love children. And none of those people had the day-to-day experience of the problem that the legislators were probably trying to address, which was crime, that these two young women did. And so where are our young people's voices in the process of deciding about things that affect them? They have experiences that we can't imagine anymore. And unless our leaders are hearing those yeah. voices, those experiences, they can't be making the best decisions they can.
Well, and yet, Loretta, this is a democratic process. The people who are in the State House today and in the governor's mansion were elected there by the people. So they feel like they're representing somebody's voice and a majority of somebody's voices in each of those districts. How do the politics play out when you talk to people who are representing parts of the state outside of Raleigh? What are they reflecting to you? What are they hearing from their constituents that leads them to believe that less government's better?
Well, I think that it's interesting to listen to the folks who are outside of Raleigh because they really are very specific to their area of what they want and what they need. And we can take something like this Medicaid issue. And for a lot of the Republican leaders who think that this might be a good idea, I think their thought is, okay, there's a sliver of a solution in here for my area of the state, because right now my area of the state isn't getting served because we have such a poverty level and folks who are sicker there, and it's not helping. There is a slight solution within this privatization where these private companies have to go to their area of the state. So therefore, you know, they might not like everything as a whole, but they're only looking at that one small thing that maybe will help out my small town. It all does really come back to the local politics.
Of course, another way to do that would be to take the 500,000 people that aren't going to be served by turning back federal money and pump that into the system.
But well, that's a whole other debate.
That's a whole other debate. I think we've got about a second and a half here. I do want to talk about the Dix property because it was back in the news today. Tell us what happened this week with that, Loretta.
Well, the Dix property, obviously this is an ongoing debate with the city of Raleigh and now the General Assembly. One of her last actions before she left office for Governor Perdue was to sign a lease with the city of Raleigh for the Dix property for a destination park. Before the ink was dry on that lease, Republican leaders in the General Assembly cried this lease because they said, you shouldn't have done this. This is such a major move. You shouldn't have done this knowing that you're stepping out of office. We have a Republican coming in. Let us take care of this. It's not, you know, we hear a lot about the fact that it's under the market value, what this lease is. I would not say that that's the major issue that the Republicans have. It's a good talking point for them. But the city of Raleigh has already said, we have the money to pay market value if that's what you want us to pay. It's not that much more. The issue is that Republicans were thinking about consolidating the Department of Health and Human Services onto one facility. They don't want to have to go buy new land. They can take this land that they have, give the city of Raleigh not so nice land within the Dix property that they can have a park that's not nearly as nice on. And this is this philosophy thing of, can we just go ahead and terminate a contract that was signed into legally? There's absolutely nothing that was not legal about this contract.
And the question of what we can do if we got more money for the property, they say we'll put more into mental health. But again, the question of transparency, accountability, mm-hmm. how do we know you're going to live up to that promise? Because it's been cut up until now. So why do we think that all of a sudden you're going to spend more? I guess that's it.
And where are you going to put it? How are you going to invest it in mental health? Those are all questions that you need answered to make the decision.
We will try to do that next time. But thank you all for being on the program. Carolyn Krueger, Program Director at Kids Voting Durham. Loretta Beniti is Senior Political Reporter at News 14 Carolina. And you've got a regular. The good news is we can check in on state politics every night in your
station.
Every
night we have a show. Capital Tonight airs at 7 p.m. across the state.
So stay tuned. And that is something that can keep us up to date. Bob Korstad, Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Coming up, the music of Mount Moriah live on the State of Things. Stay tuned.